I'm sorry. I have a headache through my entire body.
And my doctor, he don't help either. He told me to run 5 miles a day for 2 weeks. I called him up. I said, Doc, I'm 70 miles from my house.
Oh, you got that flu? Drink a lot of fluids and get plenty of rest. Man, I'm glad I ran into you. I was going to do wind sprints and dehydrate myself. Are you sure you're not a doctor?
I'm going to be sick.
All right, take it easy. I know stress is the number one cause of herpes. Headaches.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
I tell you, I meet the wrong people. That's my trouble. Like last week, I met the Surgeon General. He offered me a cigarette.
We found this one swimming naked in the fermentarium.
I am the Lizard Queen.
Give her this, and this, and then these.
Oh, thank you, Doctor.
No, I'm not a doctor.
You know, you should play with Dr. Beeper and myself. I mean, he's been club champion for 3 years running, and I'm no slouch myself.
Don't sell yourself short, Judge. You're a tremendous slouch.
Wednesday afternoon, time for the house call. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. Good to see you. Welcome
back.
Good
to see you, thank you.
Phone lines open, folks. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-CFRA. And encourage you to call right now. Okay, from the Sun, from the Toronto Sun, an Ontario doctor who topped a list of the highest OHIP billers was paid $6.4 million in a single year, the Toronto Sun has learned. The next five physicians on the list billed between $3.1 million and $4.5 million. In total for 2010, 27 physicians in the province received more than $2 million each in annual OHIP fee-for-service payments, a tab that set taxpayers back $74 million. Sun Media submitted a Freedom of Information request for the top billers to OHIP and was given data for the most recent year available. What do you make of that? First of all, did you make the $6.4 million? Was that you?
I wouldn't be here right now.
It's a lot of money. $6.4 million in a single year to be billing OHIP.
Yes.
And then the next five physicians between $3.1 and $4.5 million. So what it doesn't really say is, well, okay, so that's what they billed, but that's not necessarily what they earn.
Well, there's several things to consider. One is they didn't bill for things they didn't do. At least we're making an assumption that these are valid claims. And fee for service means that they worked for it. Every bit of that $6.4 million represents X number of patients they saw to who received the expertise in that particular area. We don't know what their specialty was, but I can probably
what kind of physician would make that kind of money?
Well, usually it's either someone who is working in an outlying area where they're the only one.
Okay.
So you can have a specialist that has to service, could be a cardiologist, could be a nephrologist, could be anybody who has to provide service to tens of thousands of people in an outlying area because they're the only person there. So we have to consider the context.
I mean, for example, I've said before, just take cardiology.
Mm-hmm.
There are only 450 cardiologists in all of Ontario.
For 13 million people.
For 13 million, 450.
Right. So what I find troubling about this report is it's somehow saying or it's implying that something wrong has happened, that this is extravagant or this is something that we have to be questioning. Why would someone be making this? Well, again, it's fee for service. So the 6.4 is all the fees that they have submitted to the government for services provided to patients. It likely represents
right.
tens of right. thousands of patients.
And who sets the fee structure? The government,
that's
right?
That's right. So yeah. And it's a very small minority of physicians. There are 25,000 physicians in the province, and they're talking about 27 physicians. So in any structure where you have groups of people that are paid, you will have a range of payments.
And I mean, these are the top 1%, essentially, right?
That's the top. Yeah.
The top 1% of people in my industry
This is the top 1%.
One thousandth. Yeah.
So it's a very small number. And before people come to a conclusion that somehow this represents an exorbitant billing of the system, you have to keep in mind that it represents likely thousands of patients, if not tens of thousands of patients, that have received services for this following a fee structure agreed to by the government. So they worked for it.
Yeah, the OMA says the expenses incurred by a doctor are no different than overhead expenses incurred by other small independent business owners, such as lease of a building, staffing, staff benefits, equipment, hydro, and electricity.
Right. So it was a, they provide their trade, they provide their expertise, and they're paid for it.
I think this is sensationalism.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's being done to discredit another series of newspaper articles, to discredit a group of people when all they've done is done their work. Yes, it's a lot of money. I'll agree to that, but don't automatically assume that they didn't earn it.
Let's say, for example, we would just work from the assumption that it was a cardiologist, somebody in an outlying area, not in downtown Toronto, or even London or Ottawa or what have you.
Yeah, they're it.
And they're it. I think about the specialty that is. You know, how long does it take to become somebody who can do a heart transplant or what have you, right?
It takes a
20 years maybe of schooling.
Yeah. It takes a heck of a long time.
Right. Yeah.
So I
don't want my cardiologist to be paid $12 an hour.
I am very disappointed with that kind of reporting, because that's what seems to be making the headlines, is the amount of money.
Oh, it makes great headlines. Yeah. A doctor made $6.4 million a year.
So the doctor, and without trying to sound flippant, but so the doctor earned $6.4 million to help X number of thousands of people, and the hockey player that just signed $98 million contract for the next 5 years or 10 years, that's okay. People say, wow, what a great deal. So there's a disconnect between the amount, that the value for money that you're getting, and sure, it's coming from the public purse, the government is paying for the service, but nevertheless, we have to be consistent in what we consider value for money. If you don't consider that to be value for money, after you're given all the information of everything that this person did in this particular year, and if you come to the decision that the tens of thousands of services provided was not value for money, because when you break it down, it doesn't work out to be very much per service over that time, then that's fine. Then you have an informed opinion.
And it's not
opinion.
As though, okay, so we use this, let's say $6 million. Billed $6 million. Maybe, okay, 40% of that probably goes to overhead.
And it's likely.
And then half of that income is taxed away one way or the other, right?
Yeah, it's likely a specialty where there was equipment involved and technology involved to provide services. Right. So you have to then pay everybody that's providing that service along with it.
So let's say of the $6 million, maybe the doctor eventually takes probably $2 million, maybe gets $2 million. I don't think if you're in the top of your field in something like cardiology or oncology or any kind of the ologies, you're going to get that kind of money.
Well, we have
anywhere.
We have now cancer research that's world class. That doesn't come by paying someone $5 an hour, right? You're attracting people into
because of the skill set that they have, right?
Because of the skill set,
and they have that skill set, and that makes them in demand,
right?
Whether they can go to New York State or California or Chicago, Illinois, or what have you.
Yeah, and they're not saying you're paying me this amount. They're providing a service added up over the year, and that's what it comes out to. So it's not a salary. It's not something we're saying we're paying you $6 million a year. Okay, go ahead, go do what you want to do. It's you start at zero. And if you see nobody, you stay at zero. If you see only a few people, you're only going to make $100, $200, $300, whatever it is. But you have to continue to provide services to patients in order to earn that
money. Well, somebody who had heart disease, who's alive because of the expertise of the cardiologist, would think that that's probably money well spent. Let's get to some of those calls here. Joy, sorry to keep you waiting. Joy.
Not at all. That was very interesting. And thank you, Rob and Dr. Dworkin.
Thank you, Joy, for that. What can we help you with today?
Yes, I'm very sorry to hear what's going on now with the against the doctors. Now, Dr. Dworkin,
yes,
I will hope that you can give me some guidance or some a little bit of help here. I have been put on a 3 months, I guess you call it, regimen for a condition by my doctor, by a specialist, and she's given me a product called, I have to, the word's funny, I can't even say, it's Norlutate. NORLUTATE, 5 milligrams. Norlutate. Would that be it?
N-O-R?
Yeah.
L-U-T-A-T-E.
Right.
Okay.
5 milligrams.
The doctor's just looking it up now on his special medicine machine.
Because it's a specialist that gave that out to you. So, okay. So, gave this for bleeding or what? For what condition exactly?
Well, the only way she didn't go into too much detail, she did say that I had what she considered a pre-cancerous condition. And she was hoping to be able to, I guess, ward it off so that it doesn't become a full-blown cancer.
So was this for a problem with the uterus, with bleeding or something?
Yes, doctor.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah.
Doctor.
So what this medication is a form of progesterone. And for progesterone, what it does is it suppresses the growth of tissue within the uterus itself.
So
it's given to some women who have a lot of bleeding, some women who have endometriosis. So it's a means of blocking whatever effect has been causing the problem as diagnosed by your physician, a means of reversing that process. And it's a relatively safe medication to take. It's not an estrogen, it's progesterone, so it will not cause increased risks of breast cancer or uterine cancer because it's not estrogen. But it is designed to shrink down the tissues inside the uterus. That is, inside the lining, what we call the endometrium. It's the inner lining of the uterus, which will bleed sometimes if there is any damage or growths occurring.
Now, doctor, this is my problem. Yesterday, my pharmacist told me that he cannot get any more supplies of this particular that he's not able to get this medicine, that it's dried up, whatever. I don't know what goes. I'm not sure what's happening. I have heard little bit excerpts on the radio that some medicines are not available readily, but he says he can't get any more.
Well, there are a couple of brands that are available. One is called Micronor, and the other one is Norlutate, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
So I would ask the pharmacist if they have other versions of this particular type of medication. And if not, then there may be other pharmacies around town that have this. It's a fairly common medication. It's not something that should be, at least as far as I know, in short supply. And if it may mean switching pharmacies if that pharmacy cannot get it for you. You can certainly even call other pharmacies just to ask them if they have it available, different chain pharmacies. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so,
I didn't realize that. What I didn't, of course, like to do that to the pharmacist.
Well, no, you're not doing it out of malice. You're just trying to find out if it's available in another chain.
Yeah, I didn't know, but like when he says he can't get it, it doesn't mean the source is dried up necessarily.
That's correct.
Because he said he can get a product called Imidroxyprogesterone.
It's a different form of progesterone. So what the pharmacist can also do is they can send a message to your physician to say that they were unable to acquire this medication in stock to be able to provide to you, and ask the physician, would this imidroxyprogesterone be an adequate replacement for this, and ask the physician for permission to substitute it that way.
So now, would you think that would you advise me to go that way or to phone around and see if any other pharmacies have it?
I would probably say do both, because it may take time for your physician to respond. So you may want to also call around and just see if it's available. And if it is, I'd get that. It certainly would make things much easier because that's what your physician originally wanted you to take. And if there's no success on that end, then they've already contacted your physician, so at least you've sort of multitasked and done both at the same time.
Okay. We have to stop here, Joy, and good luck to you. More of your phone calls right after the 3:30 news on CFRA.
My dad and I used to get along when I was a kid. God, he was the coolest man alive then. I remember one year, I guess I was about 7. All I wanted all year long was a dog, a big dog. Got totally obsessed with it, thought of nothing else. My parents didn't have any money, and my father told me the only way I would get a dog would be if I prayed really, really hard. So I did. I prayed really hard. And that Christmas, a miracle. Dad went blind. So we had to get a dog.
We were on the fence about whether we should air that one or not.
It's all right.
Chris played that for me, and I was... Yeah, I guess we can go with that. Let's get right back to the phones. Gary.
Yes.
Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm 75 years old. I've always been very protective of my hearing, had perfect hearing. About a week and a half ago, I was piling very smooth patio blocks, and one banged it got against the other, and boy, I heard the loudest noise in my left ear that I've ever heard. And ever since then, at the very start, I had sort of a fan noise constant, which has gradually turned into a low ringing, a low-pitched ringing. And it's less in early in the morning. Now, that's not the worst of my troubles.
Right.
What happened was, about 4 days ago, I have an artificial leg above the knee for 45 years, but walk very, very well. But all of a sudden, I keeled over and hit the back of my head, which I had to get eight staples in the back.
Wow.
And my balance is suspect lately, and I'm not sure if either one is going to cure, going to gradually quit. Over.
Well, what I would suggest is the following. The ear problem happened after you had those two, I guess the two stones smashed together, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so one of the things that we can think of, especially since you didn't have this before and it was sudden in onset, you may have had what we call barotrauma, meaning that the sound itself and the air wave and pressure from those stones when they smashed together, that sound wave went into the ear and overburdened the eardrum and damaged the eardrum. And it can damage the tiny bones in the ear that connect the eardrum to the inner ear and act as a means of converting that sound wave into an electrical pulse that the brain can understand. So the ear should be looked at to look for evidence of trauma. Some of the evidences of trauma to the eardrum can be some bleeding behind it.
Would he have to go to a specialist for that?
You just go see your family doctor. They can use an otoscope and just look inside the ear. That would be the first step. The second would be if there were no physical findings, or what we call gross physical findings in terms of you look at it and it looks reasonably okay, then you would go for a hearing test to see if there's been any damage to the frequency response of that ear. And sometimes they can tell if there's been some, if there is damage that occurred. But it is usually when there's a sudden change, it means that something happened immediately to cause that.
There's been a trauma.
Yeah, because it was one day there, the next day. One day wasn't there, the next day it was, and it happened after a noticeable event. So you get very similar effects with barotrauma, for example, when your ears are blocked and you go long-distance flights overseas. And the air pressure itself, because the ear can't equilibrate those pressures, you can sometimes have an eardrum that bursts, or you can get tears and you get bleeding behind the ear. You can also get the same thing if you go deep-sea diving and you don't acclimatize quickly enough.
Yeah.
The pressure.
What about
the
balance?
The balance can be as a result of the damage to the ear. That's the other possibility, because if there is any inflammation, fluid buildup in the middle ear portion, the ear has three areas. There's the external ear, which is the ear canal that leads right to the eardrum. The eardrum acts as a barrier. Then you have the area behind the eardrum where there's a cavity called the middle ear where you can have fluid that accumulates, and you have the three bones, the malleus, incus, and stapes, the three bones that will connect to the inner ear, which is the third part. But it's that middle part, if there's any damage to the ear or trauma, that can accumulate fluid. And with fluid that accumulates in that area, it's also close to the bone that houses the what we call the semicircular canals. These are the balance organs for which pretty much describes them pretty well. And pressure in the ear itself can cause those balance organs to not send appropriate signals to the brain. And so one side may tell the brain one thing, the other side may tell another where you're standing or moving, and then your eyes, which send another image, may not match up completely with that. And so your brain gets confused and you feel dizzy or you feel off balance. So what I would suggest is you need a very good evaluation of the ear, not only for the hearing, but also to evaluate. You can have a straightforward neurological exam done in your physician's office to measure balance, to also measure whether there is a problem with those balance organs as well. And then a referral to ear, nose, and throat specialist if there's any signs of those damage of that damage, but also getting a hearing assessment as well, because you want to see if there has been any loss of hearing or frequency damage as a result of that. But it just seems that it's tied in, Gary, with that accident that you had with those two blocks.
Yes, I'm hearing you very, very well with that ear on the cell phone.
Right.
The hearing does not appear to be damaged. And my general doctor, she did a visual examination.
Right.
And suggested sit on it for a while and maybe it'll self-heal.
Well, as long as you've had it looked at, that's fine. But I would say if you're getting a ringing in the ear, it does mean that there is some damage, because the ringing represents either a vibration of the tiny bones, because they do vibrate and your ear is picking up that frequency as a result of that vibration, but it can also be damage to the cochlea, which is the inner part of the ear, which is responsible for producing the electrical pulses. And sometimes with very loud sounds, it can damage the tiny hairs that are inside this cochlea. And as a result, you get frequency diminishment. So although you can hear my voice usually is around, and people's voices are usually around, I think it's 4,000 hertz. But there are other frequencies. Our frequency range is usually 100 to 20,000. And so what a hearing test will do is it may find frequencies that have diminished that normally you won't be using on a day-to-day basis, but would certainly be able to tell you if there's been any damage from one ear to the other.
This will be the last call for the Wednesday house call, and it's Louise in Ottawa. Louise.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
Good afternoon.
I have a back problem, which is a sciatic nerve,
mm-hmm.
and I have this problem. I had an MRI in 2009,
mm-hmm.
and I've had that for at least 5 to 6 years now. Now I can't bear with it anymore. Like I have, I'm on Lyrica for the pain. I'm on Hydromorphin, I'm on Tylenol 3s. So finally, after 6 months of waiting, I am going to be able to see the specialist in October. They called me.
Okay.
And I just wondered, apparently his procedures are epidermal?
Epidural anesthesia.
Yes.
Yes.
And do you believe in that? And what would you do if it was you? I'm so scared.
Well, the first off is to know exactly what the extent of the damage is. If there's a nerve root that is being
there's big
crushed.
Damage. Because I went to Cairo, I went to physio, and they all saw my MRI, and they're telling me there's nothing they can do.
Well, usually, and that's a key thing, because usually surgeons, especially neurosurgeons, are very careful with regards to who they will operate upon, because surgery does not guarantee all the time that you will get a good result, especially
right.
on the back.
That's right.
So there are procedures where they will do injections in the back to reduce the inflammation and also provide some pain relief. And in terms of risk, that is certainly much less risk to try that first before any surgery is even contemplated, because surgery you can never go backwards from. You do surgery and that's it.
What's the side effects of that?
Well, usually when you do epidural anesthesia, or if you're injecting a steroid or that into the spine, I mean, side effects, as with any injection, you can get you can get pain as a result of the fluid that accumulates in the area, just pain from the needle in that area. It's rare to have the needle go anywhere near the nerve, because that's not usually where they're going with the needle.
Okay.
Anytime you poke through the skin, there's a risk of infection. Again, as long as the procedure is done, we call an aseptic technique, meaning that you're cleaning the skin and making sure that there's no bacteria on the skin. It's a fairly safe thing to do. I have many patients that go for these type of procedures on a fairly regular basis, every 3 months or so.
I see.
And it helps them function very well and reduces their pain quite dramatically.
But is that right, that I can get paralyzed?
That I can't really provide an answer for, because I don't know the extent of the damage. But the bottom line is that if you have a nerve root in your spine that is being compressed or crushed, and if that continues, it certainly can compromise the leg and make it more difficult to walk, but not necessarily paralysis.
Okay, that's our time for this week. Thank you for all your calls. Good luck, everyone, and thanks for all those answers.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Barry Dworkin and the Wednesday House Call back on Sunday. Sunday's at 4. And don't forget, health headlines, 10 minutes to 7 during Madeley in the Morning here on CFRA.